I am Planta Online in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The noted journalist and critic Deirdre Kelly joins me again. She has just written a new book, Ballerina, Sex, Scandal, and Suffering Behind the Symbol of Perfection. It exposes the reality behind the myth surrounding ballet and gives us a peek behind the curtain to show us a far less glamorous life led by its dancers. Ballet and dance has fascinated many for a long time now. There was Billy Elliot sometime in the last decade, and it's continued with films like Black Swan, as well as television shows such as Bunheads and Breaking Point. There's also Dancing with the Stars, which fuels television audiences' interest. Deirdre Kelly is one of the leading critics on dance, appearing in the Globe and Mail, Dance Magazine, and the Dance Gazette. She's a feature writer at the Globe and Mail and a contributor to the International Dictionary of Ballet and the website criticsatlarge.ca. DeirdreKelly.com is her website. Her previous book, a really great memoir, Paris Times 8, was a bestseller. This current book is published by Greystone. She joins me from her home in Toronto this day. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Deirdre Kelly. Ms. Kelly, good morning.
Good morning. I'm so thrilled to be talking to you again.
Thanks for joining us. So as a critic, as someone who's interested in dance, do you think that the general audience, say, that's not familiar with ballet, could get interested in it?
Oh, I think what you just referred to in your introduction is sort of proof right there that dance in general, and ballet, I would say, in particular, has never stopped intriguing audiences from day one, and that day one was almost 500 years ago.
Yeah.
I think, actually, phenomena like Dancing with the Stars or You Think You Can Dance Canada has actually jump-started the popularity of dance all over again for the public. I actually can tell you anecdotally, I have colleagues at work, I'm sorry to say, call them kind of classic couch potatoes guys, mm-hmm. They are guys, that you wouldn't think would be really interested in ballet or dance, but they tell me that So You Think You Can Dance Canada and Dancing with the Stars are among their favorite dance programs, and they are riveted. I'm thinking of one colleague in particular, and I just looked at him and said, so what is it? What do you like about it? And he just looked at me as if I, you know, was coming from a different planet, and he said, well, it's the physicality. It is the brilliance. It is astonishing, you know, and I think that is a part of our ongoing fascination with dance, is that we are all with a human body.
Yeah.
Very few of us can do those superhuman feats that dancers are able to do and do it in time to music.
The on ballet and the image of the ballerina herself as the symbol of perfection, you mentioned that it goes back, what, 500 years or so?
At least that. It actually, you know, when we first start seeing illustrations of it and descriptions of it historically is during the Renaissance. It does originate in an Italian pursuit or practice. So we might be thinking, you know, 14th century, actually, the very, very beginning of ballet times would be then. In fact, our word ballet comes from the Italian verb ballare, which means to move or to dance. But it really evolves into the art form as we know it today in France during the 16th century at the start. And actually it was imported from Italy by Caterina de' Medici when she married into the royal court of France. And it's at that time where it really starts to evolve as an all-important art form and spectacle.
And then the idea that the ballerina is pure, that it also symbolizes conformity.
Absolutely. Two things I think I'm hearing you say there. What is interesting, and maybe to emphasize to your readers, historically, ballet was not a female art form. It was actually the domain of the male. It was used at the very beginning in the 1600s as a tool of discipline for instructing young men of the nobility in the arts of war. And the first ballets bore no resemblance to what we would think of ballets today. The ballets in the 16th century and 17th century tended to be more lavish, opulent, outdoor spectacles that featured men moving uniformly in strict linear procession or in geometric pattern. Our military parades of today, in fact, are rooted in ballets passed as a militaristic exercise, as are the Lippensteiner horse shows, by the way, because horse ballets were part and parcel of those opulent spectacles of the 17th century. There's a reason why women weren't at the forefront at the very beginning in ballet. If you look at historic painting or illustrations, you will notice it's the men who are wearing the tights. They are the ones showing off their legs. They have teeny little breeches on, and they're quite, you know, interested in showing off their virility below the waist, so to speak.
Yeah.
Women were literally hobbled by the costume of the day. Their dress was floor length, and it was usually held together by very suffocating corsetry and things called panniers, which I read sometimes expanded the skirt at the waist to almost 3 feet wide. So you can imagine that ballet dancers, if they were women at the very beginning, the best they could ever do was decorously glide. And I think that that's where we first get our idea of the ballerina as delicate and ultra-feminine. But also, when the ballerinas of the day, and the first ballerinas I would like to tell you, is they were all members of the aristocrats class where ballet originated, and they danced for members of their own class. So it was a very much an insider thing. And right from the get-go, these courtier women were meant to represent virtue and also platonic ideals. They were always seen as being harmonious and, you know, in step with the music, but also in step with, I think, civilized ideas. And I found that interesting, because when you look at the ballerina today, that idea of her as being somewhat remote from the rest of femalehood,
right,
you know, kind of has stayed with us. And in particular, what I found intriguing, and in fact, I have to say that's what sparked my investigation into the ballerina's history in the first place, because I really did have this question, why today is that iconography of the ballerina so potent that when a ballerina does, quote-unquote, step out of line, that is, speak her mind or even voice any kind of opinion, does the public find that unacceptable often and label her as a troublemaker?
Uh-huh.
And in fact, going beyond the public, her own profession will ostracize her for speaking out against any kinds of injustices behind the scenes. And I wanted to know, why do we react so viscerally like that to a ballerina? And I think that I found that in part the answer by looking at her origins in the 17th century.
Yeah, and it, we learn in reading the book that even today, it's not an art that is conducive to, say, feminist ideals, right?
No, it isn't, and isn't it terribly ironic? Because I have to say, I do not ever shy away from the F word. I would call myself a feminist. I was raised by a prototypical feminist,
mm-hmm.
You know, way back in the bra-burning 60s and into the 70s. And so I've always embraced this idea that women have or ought to have equality. I believe that we have strengths and that they're our own strengths. I've never, ever wanted to emulate men. I'm very proud of just being a woman. And I think that women should be allowed to exercise their opinions, their right to vote, the whole nine yards. And actually, I will tell you that I believe that is why I was initially attracted to ballet. I can tell you I was fascinated by ballet and ballerinas by the age of 3, uh-huh. at least my earliest memory. And trust me, I just mentioned with my mom, I mean, she did not take me to the ballet. My first ballet, in fact, was the Nutcracker at age 11 and a half, only to shut me up already because it cost me Nouveau.
Yeah.
But at the very beginning of my time, you know, I was intrigued by the ballerina in the same way I was totally intrigued by flying fish and horses.
Yeah.
They were all linked together. They were creatures, wonderful creatures of nature that exhibited extraordinary powers, and they seemed to me to be free and in control of their worlds. And I really do think that that's what I was initially attracted to. As I said, not having read anything, I'm just a little kid.
Yeah.
And indeed, I think that this is part of my fascination as I grew up and became a dance critic. I thought that the ballerina was in control, and then I started watching her now from behind the scenes, because I had to interview dancers, and then I got to watch ballet sometimes from the wings, and that's a completely different experience than when you're sitting in the audience. And I almost right away saw that the woman actually isn't in control, and that far from being the dominant figure in her female-centric world, she's actually dominated, and dominated by really old-fashioned, if I maybe even just use that word, doesn't even seem to apply actually, because it's worse than that, but uh-huh. old-fashioned ideas of what females should be. And it's really ironic too, and this really came to the fore again in doing my research, that this idea of a dominated ballerina is a modern concept. So precisely the same time that women were gaining greater strides in Western society in the 60s, the ballerina actually was starting to increasingly lose her autonomy as an artist in her own right, and as a woman who could exercise her own choices within her profession. And I actually will now produce a date, mm-hmm. and we can talk about that. It was 1963, in fact, is when I think it all kind of started to go downhill for the ballerina. And that is when the great Russian-born choreographer George Balanchine, he was invited to America in the 40s to help found the New York City Ballet, one of the world's great companies today. Mm-hmm. And in 1963, George Balanchine got the all-important Ford Foundation grant. And at that time, he was able to finally create a ballet company in his vision. And that vision did include an emaciated ballerina, and a ballerina who was almost overnight desexualized, or let's put it this way, only to be made available to him. He was notorious for not only urging his dancers to eat nothing, and this is because he preferred a ballerina who was long of limb, narrow of hips, you know, had a small head,
yeah.
and was Speedy Gonzales on her points. But he also was known to punish ballerinas if they dared marry. He kind of kept a tight lid on them, but he was himself a very healthy heterosexual male who not only had a series of ballerina wives within his own company, but it was known to bed them at will. Maybe that wouldn't be something that I would even need to comment on were it not for the fact that there seemed to be this really gross double standard.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like the king, he became, it was interesting, you know, le droit de seigneur of the, right. of the 17th century became George Balanchine in the 20th century.
And do you think we've gone away from that? I mean, he's still considered, you know, one of the great innovators.
I have no complaint about the man's artistry. I think he was a genius of ballet, and he absolutely pushed the art form forward in the 20th century. There's no doubt. But at the great cost to the ballerina's health, I want to add.
Yeah. And do you think that there is still, you know, that sort of the mental and physical abuse and the ageism, say, is that still prevalent, do you think, in America or even in Canada today?
You know, it's a really, really pertinent question. I can't speak for all the companies because I don't have, I guess, inside access in a way. But I actually can speak to the National Ballet of Canada because this is a company that, first of all, it's in my hometown of Toronto.
Uh-huh.
I've been reviewing it and scrutinizing it for years. I did get a National Newspaper Award citation of merit and for my investigative reporting on the National Ballet, so I've often, you know, probed behind the scenes quite deeply and maybe uncomfortably for some people. But I would say that, so this is a company I do know and I can speak perhaps to their current practices. They definitely have been guilty of some of the abuses that have plagued ballet in the modern era. But I would say that there is a growing awareness that such practices can't continue if the art form is to survive into the 21st century and beyond. We know that based on medical research and, you know, this sort of new area of arts medicine and sports medicine, that an emaciated dancer is a wasted dancer. Today's choreography is so much more athletic than it ever was. And if you do not have the muscle tone or even the bone density to get through it, basically, you know, you are a liability and a ballet company is foolish because it has now kind of created and put a lot of money into a workforce only to see that workforce fall by the wayside if it's not being properly taken care of. So that's the number one thing. And I'd say in the light of the infamous Kimberly Glasgow case of the late 1990s, in fact, that's 1998, 99, and 2000,
mm-hmm.
Labor laws that govern the rest of us in Canada have finally taken root in the National Ballet. And today, a dancer would be hard-pressed to be arbitrarily dismissed as she was in 1999, which was the case of Kimberly Glasgow. So things have changed, and I do think have changed for the better. I also would say that the National Ballet, yes, I do know that one, that company in particular, but as part of my research, I was really impressed by the Australian Ballet. It's interesting, sort of these new world companies mm-hmm. that are really kind of wanting to move with the times. And what the Australian Ballet has done has written into its constitution a injury prevention program, and it basically almost prohibits dancers from hiding their weaknesses. Because you can imagine when your body is your tool, many dancers have been reluctant to even come forward if they've hurt themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So in the past, this has been, there's some really grotesque stomach-churning tales of, you know, of what goes on when you keep dancing on a broken ankle, for instance.
Yeah.
But this has actually been the norm. And I would say that it continues to be the norm, no doubt, in lots of companies worldwide. As I say, I don't really know what's going on in the Russian companies. I don't know what's going on elsewhere. But I would say that there are signs also in America that dancers with more curvy, more fleshy, and we're not talking Rubenesque, of course, like if you even looked at these girls and I'm calling them fleshy, you're going to go, excuse me?
Yeah, yeah.
They still look like sticks to me.
Uh-huh.
But it's all relative, I guess.
Yeah.
I would say then, I'll give a couple of examples. Misty Copeland is a young, well, 20-something, buxom, and black ballerina within American Ballet Theatre, and she is really pushing through the ranks, and she's sort of the model of the new look ballerina. And also, there was a great controversy, it's now almost 2 years ago, with the New York City Ballet dancer Jennifer Ringer. She is a recovered anorexic.
Huh.
She went on the stage, she's a principal dancer, to dance the lead role in the Nutcracker, only to find the New York Times dance critic the next day publicly chiding her for, quote-unquote, eating one too many sugar plums.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was fascinating about that, you'd expect, oh, the poor dancer wanted, you know, probably slit her wrists or something and cry.
Yeah.
But actually, she was able to rise above it all. She was on the talk show circuit everywhere about this issue. And it became a red button issue because the public wouldn't tolerate the critic.
Yeah.
They wanted to put him in his place. They wanted to jump to her defense, and boy, did they ever. They demanded an apology. Now, I have to say, with ballet, it's, you know, for every step forward, it's a step backwards.
Right.
He refused to apologize. He felt like he was within his right to say so. But you know what? I think the evidence shows that that is a really old hat approach to ballet. And it is changing. And those who don't get it, that ballerinas are women and human beings, they are going to fall to the wayside.
How is it that ballerinas, they don't sweat? I mean, they obviously do sweat, because it's awfully...
They totally sweat. Are you kidding?
But it doesn't look like they do.
I know. Well, that's part of the training. In fact, I think I at one point was kind of formulating this idea, and I don't know, might have hit the editing floor, to be honest.
Yeah.
That this isn't... Think of the art form itself. It's an art form that is all about hiding, suppressing, camouflaging, whatever word you want to use there, the effort.
Yeah.
It is made to look effortless.
Mm-hmm.
So they are meant to look like they're not sweating.
Yeah.
They're not even hyperventilating. But I tell you, you spend even a minute in the wings during a professional performance by the likes of the National Ballet of Canada, and it's astonishing, and you see the schizophrenia instantly, the double culture instantly, because she's out there, she's looking like a million bucks, she's gorgeous, she's on her point, she looks completely unflappable, and as I say, and she's doing it all to the most mellifluous music, she kind of curtsies elegantly to her audience, she almost tiptoes cat-like into the wings, only once she's out of everyone's sight to grab her guts and start puking.
Hmm.
And she's bent over and she's falling down and she's grimacing and she's totally 100% a very driven and overworked human being, not a goddess. And it's really astonishing. And she's going, you know, like this. And it's, you know, it's like she's just come off the battlefield.
Right.
And then within a nanosecond, she has to pull it together, and she glides back out to do 36 more fouettés.
Yeah.
And that's the astonishment of the ballerina. I mean, I don't want to say that's exclusively a female thing. The ballet, male ballet dancer works as hard. In fact, do you know that in football, they now bring, not this present day, it's been a practice, maybe it's not openly advertised, but football players are subjected to ballet training.
Right.
Just like the soldiers of old were subjected to ballet training, because there's nothing like it for in developing the muscle and developing stamina and developing, in a way, courage. You know, you have to fight through a lot of hardship, as well as pain and deprivation, and you have to make it look gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it, and my hat is off to them.
Oh, are you working on another book?
Oh, I wish.
Yeah.
Not at the moment. I'm racking my brain, though.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you had fun writing this book.
Pardon me?
Did you have fun writing this book?
No.
It wasn't.
What? Okay, this is the truth. It wasn't fun because I had to write it really quickly.
I see, yeah.
And I was pretty well scared most of the time, and that's the truth. I mean, I don't mean to, you know, I'm very grateful that it's out, and I'm very, very grateful that I got the opportunity to do it. But to say it was fun, it wasn't. But there was something I will emphasize. It was for me a great, great honor to do it, and a great pleasure to rediscover ballerinas of the past who have virtually become forgotten once the curtain has fallen on their last performance. When I went back into the annals of dance history and I discovered for myself the accomplishments of a Françoise Prévost, who's one of our very first ballerinas ever, and from the 17th century, and then to see how she then started what is still a tradition today of senior ballerinas teaching everything they know to the younger ones. And you can almost trace in ballet a strong line from the present day, probably all the way back to court of Louis XIV. That's why if you get to the end of my book, you'll see that I make a reference to that and a ballerina actually saying that in my presence. A great ballerina of today, Gelsey Kirkland, sees her lineage all the way back to that king. But just to go back to Prévost, you know, she trained dancers we know as Camargo and Marie Salé, and who in turn influenced Madeleine Guimard, whose bust is today in the foyer of the Paris Opera, inspiring today's generation. And, you know, I'll go on to Marie Taglioni. Most people do know about her. She's the first romantic ballerina, but they very few people know about her tragic protege, Emma Livry, who burst into flame during performance backstage. And then, you know, those spitfire Italians who were giving her a run for her money. And then we go into the Diaghilev era and all these fantastic ballerinas. And I want to mention Ida Rubinstein from Russia. You know, she in her day was out of this world great. And how come we don't talk about Ida Rubinstein? You know, we don't. And I found that, as I say, it was a great honor to kind of be brought back into their worlds and to rediscover them, I think, their greatness, and that they were trailblazers. And I want the public to know that the ballet that we know today has been formed very much by unsung women artists of the past. But you started out asking me or mentioning to me that ballet is an art of conformity. And this is what's really interesting about the ballerina. Because, yes, just like those militaristic parades where, you know, people are moving in strict linear procession, well, ballet is, it's very much, as we know, that idea is in the court of ballet, and, you know, you're all supposed to look the same, you're all supposed to move the same, you're supposed to be the same height, the same weight, you know, the same kind of delivery, consistency, but it is always that ballerina who dares step out of the ranks and do something different, who's the one who has pushed the ballet as an art form forward. And that's everyone from a Prévost to a Camargo and Salé, all those pioneers, that, you know, in the 17th and 18th centuries, all the way to today. We have one of my heroines today is Sylvie Guillem. She was a protege of Nureyev at the Paris Opera, and she famously defected in the late 90s to the Royal Ballet in England. And she has a natural extension, you know, it's quite astonishing. She's the ballerina in those Rolex ads. Listeners might recognize her. But she had this kind of hyper-flexibility that I have to say wasn't the norm in ballet then. So even, you know, someone like her as recently as just maybe 10, 20 years ago, you know, was already introducing an innovation that today is the norm. And I'd say, and it's the first time I'm actually thinking and saying this, is I'd say the likes of a Misty Copeland and a Jennifer Ringer today are our latest day trailblazers. They've got natural bodies, and they're showing them off, and they're being allowed to show them off in ballet, and I think that bodes extremely well for the art form.
You've made a subject that heretofore was foreign, was unknown to me, quite compelling. Congratulations on writing this book. It's been nice talking again.
Oh, I'm so thrilled that you read it, that you like it, and that you wanted to speak to me, really. Thank you so very much for your support.
You're very welcome. The book is called Ballerina, Sex, Scandal, and Suffering Behind the Symbol of Perfection. It's from Greystone Books. Deirdre Kelly on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plotter.